Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
Oh, when you hear that music, it can only mean one thing. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for us to get this thing back, get it back together. And here we are, 2018. Hope you're having yourself a great new year. We are thus far. The Stud returns. Cannot keep a good man down. Ladies and gentlemen, it's episode 26. And ironically enough, we're going to take you back to the year 1966. It's 93 years. It's four generations. It's a story that until now has not been told. And they call the man the greatest storyteller, perhaps in the history of the world itself. Not even podcasting. Not even broadcasting. And I'm talking about the globe. Stud, Ron Fuller, get on in here. Welcome to your Studcast. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Tony, it's great to be here, man. Been chomping at the bit. Like you said, we're in 2018. Another year's gone by and another new one is starting, and I just can't wait to see where this one takes us. We're going to certainly get into to myself and my brothers and Jimmy, and we're going to get into the next generation during the course of this year, and we may be in that generation for a whole year, and I hope fans will stick with us. I think we're going to give them some history that, like we have been over the last 6 months or more than 6 months now, we're really cranking them, Tony. We're getting a lot of huge support. We don't much talk about it anymore, but it's out there. It's phenomenal. Numbers are really, really large. And I'm really just humbled by it all, as I always have been about this. It's just a great honor to be here. And a great honor to be able to talk to all these fans around the world about the history of this great sport.
Classy Freddie Blassie, a name that's going to come up today. Dick Steinborn, you'll be hearing about him. The Von Brauners, Maddox, Fritz Von Erich, Bob Armstrong, among some of the other stars that will be appearing on today's card. Stud 1966, take us back, my friend. We're back in Atlanta, Georgia, and the story continues.
Yes, it does. And I want to start off today with a little bit of, I like to do this every once in a while. I call it the Where Are They segment. I want to kind of bring people up to date on the younger generation, this third generation that's about to get cranked up here. I want to give them a little bit of insight into where we are at this point. As you know, I'm in high school. I'm playing basketball. Rob's in high school. We're starting to do well in athletics. And I want to go with this next generation here and kind of go through a few of them and give the fans out there an opportunity to find out where we've all gone and what's developing and what's happening in 1966 with the third generation. Obviously, none of us have ever gotten into the ring yet, but one of them is getting very close, probably the first one in that third generation. It happens to be a second generation for him, not third, but a second generation for him, is Lester's oldest son named Jackie. And Jackie's been a great, great baseball player in high school, an extremely good athlete, got a great build, made for wrestling. Lester's been training him, and Lester's going to be training him in the next year or year and a half. And Jackie's going to be the first one in our age group that's going to actually put on those tights and get in the ring and have an actual match. His brother, Roy Lee, is about 3 years younger than Jackie, and he's still in junior high, but he comes from that same wrestling background. He's a Welch, and he's got it in his blood. He's just chomping at the bit, probably saying, you know, he's watching his brother get in the ring, and he's watching him work out with his dad. And I'm sure Lester is spending some time with Roy Lee as well, because when you grow up in a wrestling family, you a lot of times have a ring in your backyard, you have a place where you can go and learn the skills at a fairly early age. And both these guys now are at an age and a time in which they can learn a whole lot, advance themselves a great deal. They're cranking it away. Lester, let me just talk a second about their dad. Now, their dad is still in Tennessee. He's working with Roy and Nick. They live in Nashville. Lester's still flying his plane. I mean, he's flying his rear end off. He's taking these wrestlers from television, live television shows on Saturday, from one part of the state of Tennessee to the other side of the state, down into Alabama for a 10:30 at night program live in Birmingham, or just flying his rear end off. And they are about to move to Florida. They're going to become a part, Lester in particular, of Eddie Graham's operation in Florida, Eddie and Cowboy Luttrell. Now, Cowboy Luttrell's an older guy. He's about to fade away from championship wrestling in Florida, and Eddie is about to become the man down there, and Eddie is going to rely in the future here upon Lester. That will happen probably by 1968. Lester is already in Florida. So there's some movement around from different people. Herb is still wrestling. That's oddly enough, Herb is still at it. He's 50 plus at this time, and he's starting to train wrestlers. He is going to train in the next few years David Schultz, Dr. D. He's going to train the Honky Tonk Man, Wayne Ferris. He's going to train Coco Beware, that becomes a star in the west side of Tennessee and on up into the northern part of America. Is going to be a pretty renowned figure in his own right. He's starting to get too old to wrestle in the ring, but he's certainly not too old to pass along his knowledge to these young guys that are eager to learn. A lot of those guys I just mentioned, they're West Tennessee boys. They come from that area. They've seen him wrestle for many, many years, Herb. And when you're a young guy and you watch a guy for years and years in the ring and you say, I'd like to do that, the opportunity then comes for you to be able to contact that wrestler, and that wrestler says, yeah, I'll train you. That's a phenomenal thing for a young guy. Hard to break into wrestling. It's easier when you're in the business and your family is in the business. It's kind of handed down to you. It's an easy thing to happen, but it's not so simple and easy for people like David Schultz and Wayne Ferris and Coco Beware, as an example, that don't come from wrestling families, and they have to be lucky enough to find somebody who can train them. And when you can find somebody like Herb, who's been the world junior heavyweight champion for 5 times, you've got yourself a trainer that's going to make you probably pretty darn successful in the ring. So Herb's out there. Roy has quit wrestling at this point. Roy retires, but he is still in that Nashville office. He's still running his territory. His territory is still a monster. It still comprises, and he operates in as many as 12 states. He's still doing 2 events a night, sometimes 3. He has still the same connections. He has these local promoters in some of the outlying areas that's far away from Nashville. In West Virginia, he still runs wrestling. He has these local promoters that are running business for him, guys that he can trust, and he's still got a huge, monstrous territory, and he is running now probably 20, maybe 25 years of huge success running that one territory. So he's there operating that. He's at the same time still has his dairy in Yorkville, Tennessee, which is down 80 miles or so from north of Memphis. So he's still cranking. He's an older guy in his 50s, probably nearing his 60s. He's really working his rear end off constantly and consistently. Let's talk a little bit about the Fields brothers. Those guys are still based in the Gulf Coast. They still run that Gulf Coast territory down there. Some of them run towns in Mississippi. They are still running Louisiana towns. They are running all the way from New Orleans and west of New Orleans over to Tallahassee in the panhandle of Florida, and northward as far as into Montgomery, over into Alexandria and Monroe, Louisiana. A lot of area that they're covering. And they hired Jimmy's dad, Jimmy Golden's dad, Bill, to work out of Alexandria. They need someone to run that Alexandria. They're all based predominantly in that Mobile, Pensacola area. So those cities are fairly far away from them. They need that weekly and daily presence there of as a promoter and all the things a promoter has to do to be able to make towns draw and to get business done. So they're strung out across the Gulf Coast of America down there, and they've moved Bill in there. Jimmy's training. He's training with Pancho Villa. He's training a little bit with Ken Lucas. He's got some young guys that are really good that are spending time with him, and Jimmy is going to be, in my opinion, one of the great workers that comes out of our family, and he is honing his skills now, just not wrestling. He has not gotten in the ring yet, but he is working toward it, and he's getting in that direction. The Fields boys have sons, like the entire Welch family. They don't have many girls in the family. All the family members have sons. That's what makes us one of the biggest, or the biggest wrestling family in the world, is because there's not many girls in the family. Most of the family members are boys. So everybody is going into the wrestling. The Fields brothers, their bodies are smaller. They don't have the height that the Welch part of the family has. So their boys are a little smaller. And what Lee does and Bobby does with their sons is they start them out refereeing at an early age. That's where a lot of people get into wrestling. A lot of great wrestlers started as referees, and then they get a grasp of what's going on. They become really smart about what's going on in the ring, and it makes them, as they turn into wrestlers, even better with what they do. Rob and I, we are still wrestling quite a bit. We don't have a ring in the backyard anymore because we're now moved into Atlanta. We live in the city. So we've lost that ring connection, but we still go down and we work out sometimes at the office in Atlanta that has a ring there that's all the time, that's up constantly. So it gives us an opportunity to still keep our hands and our thoughts, and our future is still pointed toward being in the ring at some time down the road. Then what's happened is we moved to Atlanta. I just mentioned it. We moved to Atlanta, and my dad moves us back to Atlanta because he wants to focus on wrestling again. He had been buying these properties and working on the properties. He goes back and forth. He has his entire career as a young guy. I recognize it right away. He spends these periods in which he really gets so engrossed in the promotion part of it and the wrestling part of it that his life just falls to the wayside and his focus is totally on wrestling. Now it's turned around. He had this little span of time that he bought the farms and he worked on farms. Now he's gone back to wrestling. His focus has turned directly back to wrestling again. He is going to have great success as a tag team. He's going to tag with Ray Gunkel. The two of them own the Georgia territory. They make a great tag team. I remember watching them many times, and they are going to start having a big impact on tag team wrestling in the state of Georgia.
You know, you talked about so much there, but I want to go back to, you're talking about Jimmy and you guys, as you guys were making your way in the ring. And I've always found it interesting that whether it was Eric Watts for his father or whether it was Jeff Jarrett for his father, you guys have come from these wrestling families. Being a referee is a great place to start. And watching the sport through the years and watching it evolve, that referee is a really important part of what goes on in there. I mean, there's a lot to learn, isn't there? It's a lot more complicated than it looks in terms of being a referee.
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes the referee is the key person in the ring, especially if you've got two young wrestlers. If you have two young wrestlers in there and there's no direction, and that happened a lot in a lot of different territories, because some territories didn't have great talent. They weren't full of these old pros that really knew how to get it done. And you had to put two young guys in there against each other. You got the heels supposed to lead the match. But if the heel's really green, he doesn't know what to do. Sometimes it's your referee that used to lead the match. I'll give you an example. It's great you brought this up. When I first went to Florida as a young guy, very green, they had a great referee there named Stu Swartz, who is still alive, still a friend of mine. I see him every once in a while. Great guy. And I would end up in the ring sometimes with Dick Slater as an example, or Bob Orton Jr. And we're both green, didn't know really what to do. And Stu would lead basically the match. He would call spots when we were down in a hold. He helped, not only helped, but he at times just really choreographed the entire match. He would handle it all from the beginning. And the booker in the early days there was Leo Garibaldi. And Leo loved the fact that Stu was really good at it, and he would turn it over to him. And not only was Leo the booker, Leo refereed some matches. He had been a wrestler and a great wrestler. The Garibaldis were a great group of wrestling stars. And Leo, after he got older and couldn't wrestle anymore, he was a referee. Leo would just, he would take over in the ring sometimes. I've been in the ring with him. I remember one match in particular, wrestling Ronnie Garvin in Lakeland, Florida. And this was probably in 1970. And we were having a match. The match wasn't supposed to end up like it ended up. And during the course of the match, Ronnie kept me on the mat pretty much for probably 30 minutes. I never got to make any type of comeback. And actually, I think Ronnie was supposed to win the match. But during the course of the match, when I started to make my comeback, Leo just went crazy. It's like the crowd just popped. And it was such a loud roar that Leo says to me, he screams. He can't. He's right in my face. I can't hear him. And I ask him twice. He's trying to say something to me. And finally could make it out. He says, "Beat him." And I said, "How?" And he says, "It don't make any difference." You know, I mean, so it was one of those moments.
Time to go home here. Time to go home.
Yeah. But I'm thinking, well, this ain't the finish, you know. And I think I might have even said that. And he said, "Kid, it don't make any difference at this point." And we were having to scream face to face. The crowd was so loud. So referees are a critical part of the equation, especially if you've got those younger guys. Now, Ronnie had been in the business a while, Ronnie Garvin, and he was great leading. But in this particular match, I'll never forget it. It was such a big pop that the referee, who was Leo, who's the booker. So, you know, it's not like a referee in there going, say, "I'm going to change it right here." Leo's the booker. And he says, "Beat him," you know, and I'm like, well, okay. So it was it's a good point you made. You know, I mean, that referee is a critical individual in the ring.
Where did you find your referees when you ran Knoxville?
I was lucky. When I went to Knoxville, I had a guy. But prior to going to Knoxville in 1973, they moved me from Tampa to West Palm Beach because they opened West Palm Beach. They wanted to give me an opportunity to promote. Eddie and my dad were running things to promote. And I found a guy that just became a friend of mine. He helped me put out posters. I did everything that had to be done in a town to make a draw. I put out wrestling posters. I had to go to the television station, make sure the TV show was going to run properly and air properly. Went to the newspaper offices and did interviews because I was wrestling at the time. But nobody knew that I was behind the scenes trying to do this promotion. I had a friend who becomes a critical part of my life named Mac, Robin McMurray. And he started doing some cards for me. Then he started, let me do this. He sold some tickets when I ran small events. He put up the ring. He just became a crucial part of my little operation there in West Palm. And we end up starting running several little smaller towns around West Palm. When I got ready to go to Knoxville years down the road, I needed money. I needed a down payment to be able to buy into Knoxville. And I didn't want to ask my father for it. And I asked Mac about it. And he says, "Ron, I will do this. I've got money saved. And I will give you." He basically loaned me his life savings so that I could make a down payment to buy Knoxville.
Good. Nice.
And in exchange. Yes. All the money he had in the bank, he said, I've got just about all of that in the bank. And I wasn't in position to come up with very much cash. And so I said, what do you want me to do in return? I want to pay you back, and well, I'll pay you a percentage. What? He says, Ron, just pay me back, but let me go with you and referee. So I started letting him referee some of those matches down there in Florida. And then when we came to Tennessee, he came with me. He was my referee forever, from the day, first match, first day, all the way through the time that I operated there. Mac Murray was the man inside the ring, and he was very good at it. He got to be extremely proficient at it, and he did not have to do much other things anymore. He would carry my ring for me. So some of the small towns, he would haul the ring. He would have people set it up, set up the buildings for little smaller events. But Knoxville itself, he'd just come and he would referee. He would referee television for me. I was lucky. I did have a couple of other referees, one guy named Tommy Weathers out of Chattanooga, great referee, been refereeing for Roy and for the people in Chattanooga for many, many years. Harry Thornton was the promoter there. He had refereed for Harry Thornton there. I'd lucked out, and I had plenty of referees. I had two skilled guys that were always available for me and always did a fabulous job.
It's fantastic stuff, man. So now we're back in 66, and the story is being told, and we were talking off the outset about all these great figures. When do they come into the picture, the Blassies of the world, some of these folks?
They start coming in about 1966. Now, we're after that big mega event. We're after the Ponce de Leon monster crowd, 38,000 fans that go there. Atlanta now is a huge wrestling monster. It's become a Memphis, like Memphis became when Dad was there. Now it has reached that same status. The auditorium downtown, I think it probably held maybe, my guess is 7,000-8,000 people, the Atlanta Auditorium, Municipal Auditorium. And it's full every week. It is packed every week, not just full. It's standing room, and they had fire marshals there every week now. After this huge crowd and at the ballpark, then the fire marshals discover the fact that, geez, man, we need to go watch these wrestling matches and check to make sure they're not overselling capacity. So they were staying on top of the Atlanta Auditorium, but they're drawing great crowds. Dad's got some super talent at this point, and he's bringing guys that aren't part of the crew to add to the card. Same thing he did on that big card, the big monster card with Glento, Rocky Marciano, Antonio Rocca, all of that type of stuff. He continues that process because he wants to keep his town big. Some of those guys just come and work Atlanta. Now, you got a territory here that's kind of split in a way, kind of an unusual situation. You got Fred Ward, who's in Macon and in Columbus, a couple of larger towns in the state of Georgia. And at the same time, you've got the Atlanta office that it goes to Augusta and Savannah and Atlanta itself. And then you run the smaller cities around him. Fred Ward down there in that Macon and Columbus area runs his little small towns. So he's running 5 nights a week, sometimes 6 nights a week. The Atlanta office is running 5 or 6 nights a week. They run small towns when they're not running. You worked in that territory. It was always, you worked Monday in Augusta, Tuesday in Savannah, Wednesday in Columbus. Sometimes Tuesday you would work in Macon. If you weren't in Macon, you were in Savannah. You worked Atlanta on Friday night, and then you worked a Saturday, little small town somewhere. And sometimes you on a Thursday, you would work a small town somewhere in the Atlanta area. Or you might go to Americus, Georgia, or some little small town for Fred Ward on the south end of the state of Georgia. So it was a strange little territory and a strange little setup. But when Dad would bring these big names in, they would work Friday night, fly them in on a Friday, fly them out on a Saturday, and they were just big guys. That there were people back in that time frame in the mid-60s that were recognized stars around the world and around the country. And those guys sometimes didn't work territories like most of the wrestlers did. They went to big cities night after night. And I did that in 73. I worked Florida all week. On the weekends, I would go to St. Louis and work Fridays in St. Louis, sometimes Saturdays, close to St. Louis, and then come home. So as your reputation grew, you reached a point to where promoters knew about you, and they would call. And they would call you, or they would contact you and say, Ron, could you wrestle for me in Dallas, or can you wrestle for me in whatever, Chicago, wherever the city may be. It was an easy deal to get yourself booked if you were a big name. You could go pretty much anywhere you wanted to. So Dad's flying these guys in here, and he flew in. I mean, I had an opportunity to see people that I'd just heard of, and it helped me because I'm the senior in high school. I know that I'm going to be in this business someday, and I go down and I watch those matches. I'm paying particular attention to it. I see it different than the fan. I'm not in the same mindset as the fan. I'm really into what the match is like and how these guys work with each other and all those things. I'm looking at it from a different point of view. But he's bringing Freddie Blassie as an example. You know, classy Freddie Blassie. He was big West Coast star. He was L.A. guy, you know, not spending a lot of time in Georgia and on the east side of the country, but he would bring Blassie in because Blassie had great talent. He had that flair about him. He was, speaking of flair, he had that little bit of Ric Flair. Flair got some of his stuff, I think, from Blassie. So he had the blonde hair. He did the whole deal like Blassie. He had a guy called the Wrestling Pro who wore a mask. I can't remember the guy's name. I wish I could, but he was really talented, had a heck of a body, was a great babyface, got over super. He kept him there pretty much all the time. He didn't fly him in and out. He became a Georgia star. El Mongo, they had a Mongolian guy. He really had a great look to him. They had a manager named Dandy Jack Crawford, great manager. So the two of them, they were Georgia talent. They stayed there. They went to all the towns in Georgia, and they became fixtures there, were big stars there. Bob Armstrong, he's cranking now. Now his second year, 2 years in, to become a professional wrestler and to become a star, it doesn't happen for you to anyone that I'm aware of in the first couple of years. It's going to take you some time to be able to crack that main event slot and to get into those upper parts of the cards on all those towns. And that doesn't happen for a while. Bob is probably now second match, let's say, where he was first match in his first year or so in the business. But there was a tremendous, you could watch his matches and see that this guy has phenomenal talent, and someday he will be a Hall of Famer. And that's exactly what happened in his case. He had a guy named Bill Dromo. Bill Dromo was a big dude. He was probably 6'5", weighed about 250 pounds. Heck of a worker, great talent. He was a Georgia regular. He was there pretty much all the time. And some of the guys that came in and out, I'll just run a few of those names past you. Freddie, I already mentioned Freddie Blassie. Fritz Von Erich was an in and out guy. He would come maybe once every 3 months. Fritz would show up somewhere on the card, somewhere in the top two matches normally. These guys would all be in there. Wilbur Snyder. Wilbur Snyder was a big name, especially in the Midwest, and he came in for quite a bit. And I really liked watching Wilbur Snyder matches because his style was different, and it affected me some in the way I was going to learn to work and what I wanted to do. One of the greats came in. His dad was Milo Steinborn, was Dickie Steinborn. Milo Steinborn was one of the strongest people ever. Had weightlifting records, phenomenal weightlifter, and worked a lot in Florida, and actually ran Orlando. He was the man in Orlando, Florida. So Milo's son, Dickie. Dickie was a talented son of a gun. He's going to wrestle for me later on down the road in Knoxville. A great, great star. A lot of guys. Now we got a tag teams. Tag teams are cranked now because Dad and Ray are the tag team champions. And so they're bringing in all these great heel teams. They bring in almost everybody. They bring Corsica, Joe, and Gene. They are there fairly regularly, kind of wrestling them on a fairly regular basis. The Vachons are coming out of Montreal, the brothers, the Vachon brothers. They are there a lot. The Medics, they bring in the Medics, who were a big team out of Tennessee and in the Roy's territory, and they brought them in quite a bit. And then the Von Brauners. Now, I want to spend a little time on the Von Brauners. We mentioned the Von Brauners. They were part of the trilogy, the Zany Knight and Georgia trilogy. They were on that big, huge card wrestling against Lester and Ray Gunkel. Lost their championship, the world titles, to Lester and Ray. These guys were exceptional talent. You've kind of taught me something, Tony. I got to where, you know, now I go back and I look and see if I can find out more history about the Von Brauners. And I find that the Von Brauners were 6 times world heavyweight champions. Mm. They had one stretch of 540 days in which they never lost. That is just phenomenal. That's 18 months that they never lost a match. Pretty remarkable, remarkable record. From 61 to 69, they were probably the best tag team in the world. And they actually got selected to the Hall of Fame. Now, I don't know which Hall of Fame, because, you know, there's all kinds of halls of fame so far as wrestlers are concerned. But these guys certainly deserve the honor, and I don't care whose Hall of Fame it was. If you're talking about a tag team combination, these guys were the tag team combination. You know, I pick a picture every week that has something to do with the broadcast and with the podcast. And this week's picture is of the Von Brauner brothers and Saul Weingroff, their manager. And I'd like people to go to the Tennessee Stud, the TN Stud website, and check that gallery out. Now, I've been saying this for a while, and I notice there's a lot of people that are looking at the gallery now. And these guys are remarkable athletes. When you see this photo, you'll go, wow, these boys were big. Back in the 60s, if you think about how big, when you see them, you think about their size then. Back in that day, they were hosses. They were real monster talents and monster big dudes, tough as they could possibly be. I also found, in looking at it, if you do a search, a Yahoo search of the Von Brauners, there's an actual 30-second match, must be from the 60s. It's one of the older matches I've seen. It's only about 30 seconds long. It's with the Infernos, who are a big team as well. And I'm going to wrestle the Infernos down the road. And there's a lot of guys that I just mentioned that I'm going to end up wrestling down the road, too. I'm going to wrestle Blassie, and I'm going to wrestle lots of guys, Snyder, and lots of guys that I've already mentioned. But this is only like a 30-second match. But if fans want to look at that, it's going to give you a feel for what wrestling looked like back in the 60s, and especially with the Von Brauners.
You know, you were talking about some of these names, some of these household names, and you were talking about your dad being a co-holder of the tag team championship and then the Von Brauners and some of these other great tag teams that came in and out. Question for you is, back in those days, you had to rely on recurring stars or guys that work different territories, and you borrow a hand from here or a hand from here to either enhance a card or to get an angle over, whatever the case may be. How did you keep those part-timers? How did you keep those guys in terms of booking them, deciding in terms of wins, deciding in terms of disqualifications, deciding in terms of screw jobs, those sorts of things? It seems like that's a lot of egos to try and keep satisfied. It doesn't seem like that'd be an easy thing to do. That era, this era, any era, but especially back then.
When you're dealing with a guy who's a big star, and he's a big star all over the country, he's dealing with a lot of people too. He's going to different promoters 3 nights a week and different talent. It's difficult. And having done that in St. Louis myself for a period of time, you don't know who you're wrestling. You don't know who you're wrestling until you get there. You don't know what's liable to happen or what they're liable to ask for. So, yeah, it's a little bit difficult. When I ran my own operations, I never did a lot of that. I got that group of guys that I felt comfortable with that were great guys, and they went out there and they gave me their best every night. I didn't have to deal with that. And there's a lot of ego involved there, and sometimes it's difficult to deal with those guys. And I just decided that, you know, I've got a good operation. I've got a great crew. My crew gives me and gives the fans the absolute best they can give them night after night, and I don't need it. Plus, we were doing great business. We didn't really need to bring somebody else because we're selling out. We got no seats anyway. So to put a bigger name on there would be silly for you because you're going to sell it out either way. And you got to pay those bigger guys bigger money. That's obvious that that's part of the equation.
What's interesting, though, is your dad, one theme we found with your dad is he dreamed big. I mean, he swung for the fences. He had a couple of supercards. He did it in a couple different places. You just wonder how back in those days, how he kept those guys. That's a lot of egos, how he kept those guys satisfied. And then with your dad, how important was wearing a strap for your father? Or did he just do that more out of necessity?
I think Dad didn't have the big ego. I don't believe he did it because he just wanted to be champion. He didn't come across that way to me, but I was never in the dressing room at that age. I really didn't know a lot about what was going on back there when the doors were closed. So I didn't know exactly how that all worked. But yeah, it was tough to deal with all these different people. And since you mentioned it, next week is the next mega event. He comes back a year later after the big one in Ponce de Leon Baseball Park. He comes back and goes to AIR, Atlanta International Raceway. He's going to the big dog track. Really, literally. So, I mean, you know, he's into that. Now he wants to say, I'm going to do this big job every year. I'm going to blow it apart every year. So we're going to talk about that next week. And I look forward to speaking about that because not many guys, not many wrestling promoters did it. They never wanted it. I don't know that they didn't want the mega event or they were scared of the mega event might fall apart or not draw what they thought they needed to draw. And he was one of the few guys that wanted to do the mega events.
And he never ran from it, which, you know, again, I'm kind of back to this. I'm like, well, how do you keep all those people healthy? How do you decide who is going to go, who is going to stay, and those sorts of things? You know, it'd been interesting if your dad or some of these guys in past your would have kept some journals, man. That would have been some interesting stuff, wouldn't it? Some booking sheets, some journals.
Oh, gosh, man. Can you imagine? That would have just been phenomenal. Gosh, they could have had books just following the different matches and the dressing room banter and what went on behind the scenes and all of that is just, as you get involved, as I got older and as I started to be a part of all that, there's a lot of great stories that come out of dressing rooms. And lots of times, if you're going to have a shoot, it's going to be in the dressing room rather than in the ring. It's going to happen back there, you know, and I've seen a few of those in my lifetime, and it's pretty scary, you know. Some of it gets pretty far out of hand, so it's really different.
Back then, what would that have been over? Somebody working too stiff in the ring, somebody taking liberties with somebody, or just the place on a card and resentment? What would more cause maybe an altercation in a locker room?
Could be all of those things. I mean, sometimes, you know, a guy doesn't want to do a job. He don't want to lose. And sometimes they go out and have a match and something happens in the ring that they go ahead and do what they're supposed to do. But when they come back to the dressing room, now we're going to settle the score here, man. You know, what's going on here? And you see things sometimes that are crazy, you know. And down the road, I'll get into some of those things. It's a phenomenal business in a way because of how it all works. And you're dealing with huge bodies and huge egos, and anything can go wrong. Anything can happen either in the ring or in the dressing room. It's like a possible train wreck every time you go in there. In some territories, it was much worse than others. Some places were run with the same type crew like I did business for years, and everybody's on the same page. And some places brings in the big people. St. Louis bring in a whole card of superstars from all over the world, and you never knew what was going to happen in those dressing rooms. It was who was going to get into it and who wasn't.
That's great stuff, and it's a good time for us to take a timeout here, let the stud rest a little bit. Stud, before we go to our timeout, you want to say a word about the special Super Stud Cast that's right around the corner, my friend?
Yeah, just want to remind fans that we have the first ever Super Stud Cast. It's going to be on Sunday, January 14th at 12:01 on Sunday, January 14th. You'll be able to pick up first ever 2-hour stud cast called a super stud cast, and it really is super because of who the content is. The content is the man, the big man himself. You can't get any bigger or any more popular, any more recognizable than Andre. And I'm doing Andre from a point of view that Andre's never been done before. I'm doing Andre from a personal friendship point of view, and not just talking about the type of person Andre is, but the types of the things that I experience while traveling with Andre, while eating with Andre, while drinking and partying with Andre. I think fans will, if they're into Andre the Giant, I don't think they'll ever hear as many good stories in a two-hour time frame as what they're going to be hearing with this Super Stud cast. Also, too, Tony, there's a $2.99 nominal small charge for this two-hour Super Stud cast, but we're going to give the fans another hour included in that price. When you do this, you get this Super Stud cast, you're going to also get a one-hour question and answer only follow-up to the Andre story called The Rest of the Andre Story. And it will happen two Sundays after. So Andre's comes on the 14th. On the 28th, there will be this one will drop. And it will be free to you. So when you pay this $2.99, you're not buying just a two-hour one. You're getting 3 hours of exclusive content. These shows will not be anywhere else on the internet. They are going to be just for these people that go and pay their $2.99, and it's our thanks to them. You can reach it two ways. You can go to the website, tnstud.com. You can click on Super Studcast. You're going to get that thing. You'll just give your information on how you want to pay, and you can pick it up then. You can get it anytime after 12:01 on Sunday, January 14th. Anytime you want it, you can go there and pay for that one, and you're going to get on the 28th, you can get another one, 1 hour broadcast, a follow-up to it for free. I think, Tony, we talked a considerable amount, you and I, about this. We feel like, I don't know how you can give fans more for that $2.99. They're going to get 3 hours worth of content, exclusive content that's unforgettable, in my opinion. They're going to get it for a dollar an hour. Less than a dollar an hour.
I mean, Stud, come on. It's like a half a cup of coffee at Starbucks. $2.99, a half a cup of coffee at Starbucks. We come back on the other side. We're going to hear from you. We've got a couple of great questions. In the meantime, David Summers has a few things he'd like to tell you. As I remind you, you're listening to Your Studcast, Episode 26. We continue right after this.
The entire world is only a few days away from experiencing the first Super Studcast. One of the most famous and beloved people on the planet, Andre the Giant and Ron Fuller, will make history at 12:01 a.m. Eastern, Sunday, January 14th. This fantastic two-hour Super Studcast will be followed 2 weeks later on Sunday, January 28th, by a bonus one-hour question and answer podcast, The Rest of the Andre Story, a first time ever double main event in podcast history. For only $2.99, you'll receive both podcasts. That's 3 hours of exclusive content and entertainment in January from America's best storyteller, the Tennessee Stud. The Super Studcast will never be available on the internet or any other platform. There are only two ways to hear these podcasts. Anytime you want to listen on January 14th or later, go to tnstud.com and click on Super Studcast and follow the directions. Or go to patreon.com/studcast and click on Super Studcast. It's that simple. Go back to the same location you ordered from on January 28th or later and click on The Rest of the Andre Story. You'll pay only $2.99 for both. Once again, either tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast will saddle you up for an unforgettable ride. And now, back to Studcast number 26 with Tony Basilio and Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud.
And we welcome you back, Tony Basilio, back with you on your Studcast, episode 26. Time flies, you're having fun. It's a half a year, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls and children of all ages. And In a short while, we are going to be bringing you the Super Studcast. Make sure you don't get left out. Go to tnstud.com online and check out more about the Super Studcast featuring the life and times through the eyes of Ron Fuller of Andre the Giant, the eighth wonder of the world. And Stud, to me, it's a wonder anybody listens to any of this, anything that I'm remotely involved with. But that said, we do have a couple of questions from our learned audience. And if you're game, let's do this.
Good. Let's get them.
Question number one comes from Todd Flynn, beautiful Sevierville, Tennessee, proving that the country folks can survive. Asked, besides family members, is there anyone you wish you would have wrestled but never did in your illustrious career, Ron Fuller?
Darn, I got to give it just a second of thought here because you're talking about a lot of people. I saw a whole lot of people wrestling in my life, and there's one guy that jumps out at me real quick that was about my same size. I think his height was 6'8". I believe he was probably close to 300 pounds. He wrestled a whole lot in Canada and the northern part of the United States, probably quite a bit for Vern, and certainly for the guys in Toronto and Montreal. And his name was Don Leo Jonathan. I remember seeing him pictures in magazines and thinking at that point I was about 6'4" when I started seeing stuff on magazines about him, and they were talking about his 6'8" and his 300 pounds. And I remember thinking as a kid, I'm smaller then, much smaller, like, gosh, I wonder what it'd be like to be that size. And I pretty much attained that size. I actually grew taller than that. I just didn't get that body size that Don Leo had. But Don Leo Jonathan, and I got to see a few matches with Don Leo, his ability and what he could do in the ring. He was like me. He could drop kick. He could fly and head scissor. He would do things in the ring that a big man that size is not supposed to be able to do. That impressed me. Always, I told myself, I want to work like Don Leo Jonathan. I never got to work with Don Leo Jonathan. I worked with some big guys, some guys in the same time frames with Hulk Hogan, obviously, with Tex McKenzie, with Big John Studd, with Big John, the old Big John guy. He's about that same size. A lot of big guys I had the honor and the pleasure of working with, but I would have really loved to, thinking back on it, Don Leo Jonathan would have been my choice to work with him. Would have been a real pleasure and an honor. I think we could have had a phenomenal match.
When you were a kid, you got in the ring with some of the guys that you grew up watching or reading about in the magazines. And everybody invariably that I've ever known that gets into the wrestling business began as a fan. Well, mostly everybody. I guess there are a few people that get drafted because they're big bodied and know little about it. But for the most part, people grew up as fans and then they have a chance to get in the ring with these guys. I can't imagine, Stud, what that's like. It must be just terrifying to get in the ring with somebody. I mean, I play music and I couldn't imagine actually playing next to some of my favorite guitarists. I mean, even if I was just playing chords for them, I'd be scared out of my mind. Did you find yourself at times, you know, incapacitated by fear? You get across from somebody that you want to have a good match with them. You want to have a good showing.
Oh, yeah, of course. Hell, I loved wrestling. I mean, it was my life from a little small boy. And once I got to be a pretty big star and started to have the opportunity to wrestle with these big people and the big names, I appreciated the fact that I didn't know who I was going to wrestle when I go to St. Louis, because I knew every time I went there, which was every other Friday night, that I'm going to step in the ring with some of these guys I've seen for years that I've never dreamed about, that I'm going to be looking eye to eye with them and down there competing with them and working with them. I was always honored. Sometimes I was in awe beginning of the match, but when you start and the bell rings within a couple of minutes, the awe is gone. At that point, then it's what can I do and how can I make this as good as I can make it? But yeah, it's pretty awe-inspiring sometimes to look across the ring at guys that you have looked up to for 10 years and never thought you'd ever step foot in the ring with them. And there they are, pretty big time.
Let me give you question number two. And I want to thank once again, Todd Flynn out of Sevierville, Tennessee. Question two today comes from Donovan Graham. What a great name. He's from Dufuniac Springs in Florida. Boy, he gets to the heart of the matter here, Stud. I hope you've got the saddle. I hope you've got that thing uptight on you now. I don't want you to get thrown from the horse. Here we go. Was there a beef with the Gulf Coast wrestlers when you took over the Mobile area? Or I hear Rip Tyler Dick Dunn, Eddie Sullivan, and Billy Spears were reluctant to work with your promotion. Is that true, Stud?
That's a good one. Some of that I've never heard. I've never heard that there was any animosity or anybody that didn't want to work for me. And it's kind of funny now that you got Rip Tyler, and let me get these names. You got Rip Tyler, you got Dick Dunn, you got Eddie Sullivan, and Billy Spears. Okay. Some of those guys I'd worked with a lot to buying that business down there and to starting down there on the Gulf Coast and change it to Southeastern Wrestling. And one of them was Dick Dunn. Now, Dick Dunn, I worked with him in my very first wrestling match in Arkansas with him and Don Carson. And I worked with him for 3 months in Australia. Dick Dunn, great guy, personal friend of mine. I don't think Dick Dunn had any animosity toward me whatsoever. I believe Dick Dunn was in his latter years, and he was basically thinking about retiring. And I had a good crew when I went there. I had a great group of wrestlers in Knoxville. I was prepared to open a second business. I had brought my territory in Knoxville, filled it with talent. Great talent. I actually hired Rip Tyler. Rip Tyler couldn't have been upset because I needed a manager for my assassin team that I put together at the beginning down there, and Rip Tyler was the man. So Rip Tyler, I don't think he would have been upset. Dick Dunn, I don't think he was upset. Eddie Sullivan, I used. When I went down there, Eddie Sullivan worked for me for probably the first 4 months, and it was my first opportunity to spend any time and to do any business with Eddie Sullivan, a great guy and a darn good worker. And he was so good that when I went there, I was smart enough to look at the existing crew and say, I don't want to go in here with an all new crew. I need to keep some of these faces here so that I don't lose business. I don't have my fans walk away before they get into the new people. So Eddie Sullivan was one of the guys I kept because I noticed his talent. And I saw that he was good. So I kept Eddie Sullivan. Billy Spears worked for me later on down the road. He did not work for me originally, but he did work for me later on down the road. So I know Billy very well, and we had a great relationship. I had a lot of wrestlers that liked working for me. They just really liked working in my business, wherever it was, whether it was Knoxville or down there or Continental, whatever it was. And I had a good reputation, thank goodness. And I don't know of very many people that didn't want to either work for me or just flat didn't like me. And that's kind of I guess that's the answer to his question. A couple of those guys, I'm very sure, like me. And I know that if they felt bad or any animosity, if I hired them and they got to work and continue to stay there, obviously they couldn't have been mad about that. And the others that didn't get hired then worked for me later or worked for me previously. But that's a great question. I can't imagine how he got the idea, but somehow, if he did believe that that was the case, maybe I've kind of straightened it out here.
Well, it's good to know all these years later you had heat with these people, which is one of the things I love about the internet and the stories that fly around. And you never know, maybe a couple of those guys tell people. I mean, that's very possible too, right?
Oh, yeah. Guys are like, it used to be a telephone or tele-wrestler. I mean, it was like guys talk, man, in the wrestling business. Everybody knew everybody, and they heard stories of good, bad, and the ugly. So it was hard to keep everybody on the same page and hard to have everybody like you because sometimes they're going to hear something bad about you, and they may take that to be who you really are. I tell you what, out of those two questions, I'm going to take that last one. I mean, God, that's a pretty darn good question, about these guys being unhappy with my coming down there and taking that business over. I think his name was Donovan. Donovan, that sounds like a winning question to me.
Yep. Oh, Donovan Graham, Tifuniak Springs, Florida. I don't know if you know where that is, Tifuniak Springs. That sounds nice and warm, though. From my perch in Knoxville, it has been a brutally cold winter here thus far. Spring can't get here quickly enough for me.
I know where Tifuniak is. In fact, I have wrestled in Tifuniak Springs. It's along Interstate 10 between Pensacola and Tallahassee on that I-10 Panhandle Drive. I've been there to Tifuniak, and maybe Donovan's even seen me wrestle. That's a great area down there. I love that Panhandle, Florida.
Hey, Stud, we're about ready to wrap things up here. Anything else you'd care to add in today's edition of the Studcast?
No, just thanking the fans. I want to thank everybody, the listeners worldwide, and they are now worldwide. It's just a pleasure. I want to keep reiterating the fact that it's a pleasure to do this. I want to remind fans that this Super Stud Cast is out there, but we are still going to do these studcasts for you every week. It's not going to cost you anything at all. If you want to hear this one with Andre, you think that that might be something that you'd want to hear, we're not just going to give you that one. We're going to throw you another hour after that for free, too. I don't know how we can make it any better for you than that. I know that the comments that I have seen since advertising this on social media, I have heard one bad comment. They say, oh, the $2.99 is nothing. We can't wait. We love it. We just can't wait to hear it. We're going to rock their world with this one, Tony. We're going to rock their world with the Andre Show.
Well, Stud's not going to tell you this, I am. Look, Stud's not on one of the huge networks doing this. Stud's not making any money doing this. He's not. And I'm not. And so if anybody wants to rip the Stud for charging for the Andre Show is two solid hours. And let me tell you something. It is time well spent. If you like the history of the sport, you want to hear some stories that you will not hear anywhere else. And Andre personalized in a way that, I mean, the Stud just brings him to life. I just don't know any other way to say it. I found myself, Stud, we did that show, I found myself thinking about Andre the Giant and going back and looking at some of his matches and thinking about some of the points in time where you placed him and the way you personalized the guy. And it's just really well done. So, look, we're not on one of the major networks here. You don't hear a bunch of advertisements during this deal. If you choose to support it, support it. If you want to bitch about it, bitch about it. But I'm with the Stud 5,000%. That is a product that's worth a couple bucks to you. And then you're going to get the extra hour on the back end of it. Stud, again, thank you for your time. We come back. We're going to be in episode 27, right in that sweet spot in the mid-60s. And your dad's got another supercard coming at us.
That's it. I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait. Thank very much all the fans out there. And we just are honored and pleased to be here and sitting in the seats we're sitting in and being able to do what we do.
No question. David Summers on the way out. I want to remind you, my name's Tony Basilio. You can find me at TonyBasilio.com. I do a show in beautiful Knoxville, Tennessee, a sports show. And also on my website, I have a ton of interviews and several subjects, including some wrestling personalities, some different things like that. So I'd encourage you to check me out if you get an opportunity. He's Ron Fuller Welch on Twitter. And also, remember, check out TNStud.com. Learn more about the upcoming Super Studcast featuring Andre the Giant that is going to be dropping shortly. In the meantime, for the great Ron Fuller, this is Tony Basilio kicking it over to David Summers as we hope you have yourself a great and a studly week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For inquiries about vocal work, send an email to davidsummersproductions@gmail.com.